From KCRW in Los Angeles and PRI, Left, Right, and Center presents 1 Year Later.
1 Year Later.
Can you believe it's 1 Year Later?
1 Year Later.
1 Year Later.
This land is your land. This land is my land.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Rubin, one of your hosts for the special series 1 Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. It's the Trump era, and we're taking a new approach to political debate. Today, President Trump has gone after the FBI, judges, and the First Amendment. So far, his vendetta against so-called sanctuary cities has failed, and his attorney general won't start an investigation against Hillary Clinton. But is Trump a threat to the rule of law? Will he spark a constitutional standoff with a special counsel? Will the GOP forfeit a claim to be the party of law and order? That's coming up on 1 Year Later after headlines from NPR.
Check out KCRW's All News channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
We're back with 1 Year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Jennifer Rubin, opinion writer and author of the Right Turn blog at The Washington Post. Donald Trump has attacked the idea of the rule of law. He's abused the rule of law, and he risks setting off a crisis for the rule of law, a key aspect of democracy. Here to sort it all out is Ian Bassin of Project Democracy and a veteran of the Obama White House. Hi, Ian.
Hey, Jen. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. Also here is Ben Wittes, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and one of the authors of the indispensable Lawfare blog. Hi, Ben.
How are you doing? It's good to be here.
Nice to have you. And joining us is Susan Simpson, an attorney in Washington, D.C., and the host of the 45th podcast, obviously a reference to our 45th president. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Jen. Good to be here.
Let's look at these three categories. Attack on the idea of the rule of law, Trump's own abuse of the rule of law, and then whatever crisis he may set off. Susan, Trump has attacked so-called judges. He's demeaned the FBI. He says it's a horrible idea for the press to be able to write whatever it wants. He led chants of lock it up against Hillary Clinton. His defenders say this is just Trump being Trump. But is there something bigger here? And why is the rule of law now a phrase that's come up again and again in the coverage of this president?
I think he is just Trump being Trump, but that's also disregard for the law. I think one of the bigger stories to come out, kind of got under the radar there, was a report not too long ago about how in June, Trump was meeting with some tribal leaders about energy resources out in the West, and they said, we want to do this thing, but we have regulations we're trying to get through, and Trump told them, I'm in charge now. Don't worry about it. Just go for it. Just do it. That's how we do it now. And that kind of shows his whole mindset for how the rule of law applies today.
Ben, one of your colleagues, Jack Goldsmith, recently wrote that not only is Trump setting up a potential crisis, which we'll talk about later, but he is really demeaning and demoralizing our law enforcement personnel. Is that a real concern at this point? Today we saw, for example, Chris Wray, the head of the FBI, up on Capitol Hill testifying and being asked questions like, is your department in tatters?
Yeah, it's very much a concern. I mean, from the beginning of the Trump administration, he has shown a pattern of the grossest kind of disrespect for the idea of law enforcement as a function of government independent of politics. And, that started with asking the then FBI director to essentially give him an oath of loyalty. It's involved, asking the FBI director to back off of an investigation, one that recently came to fruition in the form of a plea agreement from the individual Michael Flynn in question. And it then involved, pressure on the FBI to handle the Russia probe in a fashion congenial to the president. And it's involved serially, after the removal of the FBI director, taunting and threatening to fire and threatening the attorney general, the deputy attorney general, and the special counsel. So, I mean, the pattern of engagement with law enforcement is just, it couldn't be more disturbing and consistent.
And some would argue that's sort of the center, the core of what we're talking about here. Ian, you head Democracy Project. What is that and what are you trying to do or what are you trying to prevent?
Protect Democracy is a nonpartisan nonprofit that we formed earlier this year, frankly, to prevent the decline of our democracy into a more authoritarian form of government. And I think when we first started using that word, we were worried that people might raise an eyebrow and roll their eyes and think we were being somewhat alarmist. I think actually the scariest thing was that nobody did that. And this may be why. If you look at the rise of autocrats around the world in the 21st century, people like Erdogan in Turkey or Putin in Russia, it took them 4, 5, 6 years in office before they started doing some of the things that we're seeing already in the first year of the Trump administration. Recall when Erdogan took over in Turkey and when Putin took over in Russia, they were seen around the world as democratic reformers. Erdogan was going to bring Turkey into the European Union. Putin was going to extend Yeltsin's democratic reforms. And it wasn't really until about 5 years in office that people started to say, uh-oh, something's not right here. What we've seen in the first year of the Trump administration is a range of behavior characteristic of autocrats around the world, from the attacks on the rule of law, the attacks on the courts, the spreading of misinformation, the Pence-Kobach Commission, which is, you know, pretty transparently designed to go out and suppress votes to corrupt elections, the pressuring of private employers like ESPN and NFL to quash speech. These are patterns that should be very disturbing in a democracy.
Ian, let's continue on for a moment. I'm speaking with Ian Bassin, who heads the Project Democracy. Trump's lawyer this week has said something that at times we've heard from right-wing pundits, which is the president can't commit obstruction of justice because he's the chief law enforcement officer. And then we heard a defense in a civil case brought by an alleged assault victim who is now suing for defamation. And now we hear from the Trump legal team, he can't be sued. Didn't we cover this ground under Nixon and then under Bill Clinton?
Yeah, I mean, the crazy thing about the argument that the Trump lawyers, his personal lawyers, are making in New York State Court that he can't be sued for acts that he undertook in his personal capacity before assuming office is that the Supreme Court did resolve this in the Clinton v. Jones case. Now, the Trump lawyers are trying to hang their hat on a small footnote in that case that said it applied to federal court and that state court was another question. We at Protect Democracy filed a brief in that case on behalf of the same three law professors who filed a brief in the Clinton case saying the exact same thing, which is a pretty simple concept that most Americans understand, which is that the president is not above the law. And that's true whether the president is a Democrat, Bill Clinton, or a Republican, Donald Trump. But I think what's really disturbing about the two things that happened this week, the Dowd quote that the president can't obstruct justice, another way of looking at that is the president is saying, I can't obstruct justice, I am justice. And the argument in civil court is that this is part of a pattern of President Trump basically saying, I cannot be held accountable by any mechanism out there, be it a court, be it the Congress, be it the special counsel, be it the FBI investigator. He's never met an accountability measure that he thinks is actually worth existing in a democracy.
On this program, we've also asked listeners to chime in. Here's a recording from one of them. Let's listen to that now.
My name is Eric Klayman. I live in southern New Jersey. And I did vote for Trump for president, although it was more a vote against Hillary, more than it was a vote for Trump. Speaking about the rule of law, look, Mueller's investigation is scary in the sense that it has no boundaries. He's supposed to be looking at Russian collusion, and he has no budget and no boundaries. And I think any time that the administrative state or the police state, in this sense, the Department of Justice, has no boundaries, we as citizens are always very leery and, in fact, scared. Mueller's investigation, although well-intended, I'm certain, needs to have boundaries. And it's one of the reasons that Trump was elected, was these type of no boundary investigations or agencies or rules and laws and administration. It just grows and grows without the people's comment.
That was a KCRW listener. If you want to share your perspective, you can go to our webpage at kcrw.org/one year later. Susan, is the listener correct? Are there no boundaries on Robert Mueller?
Well, there are clearly boundaries laid out from when special counsel was appointed. Rosenstein set out the areas.
That'd be Rosenstein, who's the deputy attorney general, now acting as the supervising attorney general for purposes of this investigation.
Yes, and it was a great move. And same for Sessions recusing himself, which was necessary here as well. And there are limits laid out in that document that describe what he can look into. And it's predominantly related to election-related activities and collusion with Russia. But in the course of that investigation, it's clear that this is a bigger issue. It's not some simple, discrete action that was happening, and his investigation is following that. That's appropriate in any special counsel investigation or any investigation, and there's no indication here that he has exceeded the bounds in any concrete way that I can think of. It's possible the listener was referring to sort of the financial subpoenas that have gone out, but from what we know, that is also very directly tied to activities of Manafort, for instance, or the Cyprus banks accounts. And it's nothing that we've seen so far suggests that this is actually a limitless, wide-ranging probe.
Ben, you've said, and I've agreed with you, that it's not too early to start thinking about impeachment, not beginning proceedings, but thinking about it. Why is that, and what would articles of impeachment actually look like in a formal proceeding against this president?
Well, so first of all, let me just say that I think you would want, before you decided how to proceed in an impeachment context, you'd probably want to hear from Bob Mueller. In contrast to your caller, I actually think that Mueller has been remarkably disciplined about staying within the confines of a fairly broad mandate, but his four cases that he's brought so far, either through pleas or through indictment, have been pretty close to the molten core of what the investigation was supposed to be about. That said, look, impeachment is not a criminal proceeding. It's a proceeding to evaluate the fitness and of the president or some other civil officer of the United States, and to ask whether his conduct justifies his removal from office. And I think the argument in the case of Donald Trump that there have been abuses of power, whether criminal or not, that should be examined pursuant to the impeachment power is pretty overwhelming. And that's not to say that Congress should impeach and remove him, but it is to say that if a member of Congress who takes his or her oath of office seriously looks in the face of the president's behavior toward law enforcement over the past year and comes away with a sense that that's all, you know, sort of proper and none of it abuses power and it's all consistent with the way we want presidents to engage with law enforcement, they live on a different moral planet than I do. And so if I were a member of Congress and I looked at that pattern of activity, I would say this raises a question under the impeachment clause, and I have an obligation as somebody who has sworn an oath to preserve and protect the Constitution to examine this conduct under that provision of the Constitution.
And boy, if there were ever a case that the cover-up is worse than the crime, this certainly seems to be so. The nub of this was supposed to be alleged collusion, and as Trump never tires of reminding us, we don't have evidence, direct evidence, that he did that. But his reaction to this investigation sure has been troubling. Ian, well before we even get to impeachment, doesn't Congress have a role to play here? Aside from these investigations, we have things like the Foreign Emoluments Clause. We have conflicts of interest. We have all sorts of financial issues going on. What should Congress be doing here?
Well, the good news here, and there is sort of a ray of hope, which is that our democracy still does work, right? There are flaws in it all over the place, but fundamentally it works. And sort of one of the great reminders of it, right, when the administration was coming into power, was a rather arcane move that Congress was considering to defang the Office of Congressional Ethics. And the New York Times quickly put a headline story up right as that was happening. And people around the country called into Congress in droves and shut that down in a heartbeat. And what was interesting about that is normally the American public doesn't engage on those types of process issues. And here they did, and they did very effectively. And so I think there are tools that we still have at our disposal as citizens to get Congress to do more than it's doing in terms of holding oversight hearings. And they are obviously investigating Russian interference in the 2016 election and potential coordination with the Trump campaign. But they really do need to hear more from Americans. And so I think this is a moment, you know, when listeners are sitting at home hearing some of these quite scary tales of the moment that we're facing, where this is a moment that calls for active citizenship. If we were ever wondering what we would have done at moments in history when democracy was imperiled, this is one of those moments. And there still is an opportunity to engage with the members of Congress and urge them to really exercise their oversight responsibilities, because the founders intended for the first branch of government to be the Congress and for the Congress to hold a president accountable when he stepped outside of the appropriate role of the president. So, you know, if people are looking for ways to do that, we've tried to empower folks at protectdemocracy.org by providing a way for people to sign up, get information about when there are things happening in Congress where you can weigh in and say to any of the investigators looking into President Trump's abuses of the rule of law, I'd like to see my member do more to hold him accountable.
We're going to have to leave it there for just a minute. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue the discussion of attacks on the rule of law and see if Trump is going to set off a constitutional crisis. This is 1 year later from KCRW. I'm Jennifer Rubin, and this is 1 year Later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. Today, we're talking with my guests, Ian Bassin, Susan Simpson, and Ben Wittes, about Trump's attacks on the rule of law. Let's turn to whether Trump is going to set off a constitutional crisis. Today, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer took to the Senate floor. Let's hear what he has to say.
Spuriously attacking Robert Mueller, one of the most respected and trusted civil servants in our country, is the surest route to losing all your credibility. I'd remind everyone on the right who are trying to muddy the waters on the Mueller investigation, Robert Mueller was a career prosecutor who served both Republicans and Democratic administrations in the most trusted of roles. He was appointed by President Trump's own Deputy Attorney General. It defies his credulity to lambaste him as partisan or biased. He's as straight a shooter as they come. But this is bigger than one man, Mr. President. The attacks on Special Counsel Mueller and his investigation erode faith in the rule of law, the bedrock principle at the heart of our civic life.
Ben, recently three lawyers who were writing for an organization called Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Government, in Washington, rather, said it's going to be harder to fire Bob Mueller, even if the president wants to, than he might think. What are some of the legal protections that are or might be imposed to keep the president from firing Mueller?
Well, so the existing ones are these appointed pursuant to a regulation that specifies who the hiring and firing authority is. And the hiring and firing authority is not the president. It's the attorney general. Now, the attorney general in this case is recused, so the hiring and firing authority is the deputy attorney general, who shows no particular interest in wanting to fire Robert Mueller. So that means if you wanted to get rid of Mueller under the regulation, you would have to either persuade the deputy attorney general to do it, or you'd have to fire him and replace him with somebody who was willing to do it. If that sounds a little bit familiar, like, say, the Saturday Night Massacre, it's because we've been down that road before. So the other way you could do it is by rescinding the regulation, but that gets into the whole world of how easy it is or is not to create and eliminate regulations. In addition, there's been a move on Capitol Hill, a sort of bipartisan move to try to build in legal protections in statute for Mueller. I'm personally a little skeptical of these efforts, but I do think they highlight fairly strong bipartisan support for Mueller's investigation. There certainly has seen some fraying of that in recent weeks as many Republicans have started attacking Mueller. But there's still a core support for the idea that the investigation should proceed unmolested by the president.
Right. Other people have raised those concerns, Ben, too, about Congress trying to legislate in this aspect, that it might infringe upon the Article II powers of the president. But let's suppose that he clears all these hurdles or he ignores the hurdles, Susan. What happens if Donald Trump fires Robert Mueller?
I think we're going to see something that's going to be in the history books for a long time to come. My hope is that Congress will actually find itself and stand up to him. I don't know if that will happen. Nothing we've seen so far really gives me confidence that whatever Trump does, he'll face a check from the other branch of government. I think it'll likely be up to the people at that point, unless there's sustained opposition and constant pressure from all of America. I think we could be in a lot of trouble. That said, maybe I'm being too cynical here, and it's possible that Republicans in the House and the Senate will step up and decide this is the line too far. This is not the point you can go to, and take some action from there. Maybe not impeachment, but something severe at that point.
Right. Now, next year we do have elections. Do you think it's going to take a Democratic majority in one or both houses before we see some real activity here? The Republicans sure have not seemed very keen on pushing ahead, aside from the Senate Intelligence Committee, which seems to be doing its diligent best. There's not been an overabundance of bravery when it comes to taking on their own president.
I'd be shocked if we saw anything happen before an election happens and the balance of power changes. I mean, it's the party of Trump now.
Sadly, I think that would be right. Ian, we're going to either see a constitutional face-off with the president and with Robert Mueller, or we won't. But what do people do now if they're concerned about the rule of law, if they fear that we're going down a track? What are some practical things that people could do or that organizations that have funding could be doing right now?
Well, there's two things. I mean, the first is, I think while it's certainly possible the president could fire Robert Mueller, the other thing that they may be thinking, and I think this is indicated by the John Dowd, the president's lawyer, tweet about how the president can't obstruct justice, is that firing Robert Mueller might create some sort of backlash from Republicans on the Hill, probably not enough to protect him, but some backlash. But just smearing the investigation as partisan could drive Americans into their respective tribal camps. And I think that's what we're looking at as the probable strategy now, is make it so that if you're a Republican, you say Mueller is partisan and not fair, and if you're a Democrat, you back him. And that would be a really dangerous thing to do, dangerous thing to happen. Andrew McCarthy at the National Review has a very good piece online this week about how our law enforcement officials take an oath to uphold the law, and they all have private lives and they all have private preferences. They're human beings, but when they step into their job, they do what the Constitution requires. And I think the first thing that Americans need to do is we need to be willing to speak out publicly in our communities to each other, reinforcing this notion that the rule of law is important and that people, whether they're Democrats or Republicans in their private lives, can be trusted to take an oath and uphold it and support that idea. But that's not the only thing. The second thing is we need to do strategic legal actions that are joined by a movement of the public. So at Protect Democracy, we have been challenging the president's abuses of the rule of law. We filed a lawsuit challenging his Arpaio pardon. We've brought a lawsuit challenging his attempt through the Pence Kobach Commission to suppress voters. We filed a brief in the Summer Zervos case saying the president is not above the law, but those actions can't stand by themselves. They need to be joined with a movement of people. So we've encouraged Americans concerned about this to come sign up at protectdemocracy.org so we can help inform people about when there are moments to call your member of Congress, tell them what steps they can take to either hold hearings or enact legislation that will reinforce the rule of law and allow America to survive this moment and hopefully emerge stronger for it.
And that suit that Ian Bassin referred to is the suit involving former sheriff Joe Arpaio, who was actually held to be in contempt, criminal contempt of court. And of course, the president pardoned him. Some seem to believe that that was an effort to test the waters to see how the American public might react if he, for example, pardoned his son or pardoned his son-in-law or pardoned any of his senior advisors. Ben, we have this other constitutional amendment actually hanging out there, the 25th Amendment. What's that all about? And are we going to get into 25th Amendment territory?
So the 25th Amendment is a provision added to the Constitution after the Kennedy assassination to deal with the problem of presidential disability and the specific issue that caused Congress to send it to the states for ratification was the concern what would have happened if Kennedy had been put into a coma by the shooting but not died. And the Constitution had no obvious answer to that question. And so the 25th Amendment creates a mechanism by which the cabinet can declare the president incapacitated and the president, the vice president then kind of takes over. The problem, a lot of people talk about the 25th Amendment as a potential solution with respect to Donald Trump, and I think they are fantasizing, to be honest, for the following reason. First of all, it is completely unclear as a matter of constitutional law what the 25th Amendment has to say about a person who is, pretty nutty and very eccentric, but no more nutty and no more eccentric than he was the day he was elected, right? And so Donald Trump is actually exactly the person who the people voted to make president. And so in a way that is not true of the impeachment power, where you're actually responding to an act, the 25th Amendment really is kind of potentially overturning the result of an election. The second problem is that, of course, it relies on a political decision, which is the outcome, which is a collective decision of the cabinet that we simply have no reason to believe that would actually happen. That is, these are all people who were appointed by Donald Trump, who serve at the pleasure of Donald Trump. It's very hard to imagine the circumstances in which they would kind of get together and say, okay, let's behind his back declare him incapacitated for 25th Amendment purposes. So it's there. It's a theoretical possibility. But I've always thought it was both from a democratic governance point of view and from a likelihood of happening point of view, a pretty remote possibility.
Right. And of course, the vice president would also have to join in that. And so far, Mike Pence has been the dutiful, to put it mildly, vice president. It is interesting that there's another clause of the 25th Amendment that says that Congress can appoint a body in lieu of Congress as a whole to make this recommendation to try to get the president moved out, at least temporarily. A freshman congressman from Maryland, Jamie Raskin, has about 50 co-sponsors this week in an effort to try to constitute that body. I suspect that that's not going much of anywhere. Susan, in the last couple of minutes that we have here, what do you think the American people view looking at this entire picture? Do they see this in terms of collusion, not collusion, or are they beginning to suspect that there's an abuse of power? That's a generic term, not necessarily a legal term, but essentially what brought Richard Nixon down, the sense that there was a president who didn't understand the legal boundaries and was doing things that distorted the framers' intent. Do you think the American people yet have a conception of that?
I think the majority of American people do, for sure. You look at opinion polls and people, how they feel about right now in this moment of history. And despite the fact the economy is still looks like it's going strong, there's an overwhelming negative approach to what's happening right now. And I think it's a recognition that we're in a dangerous territory. I mean, Trump has an authoritarian soul. And if there's one saving grace we might have, it's that he doesn't have the knowledge to know he ought to hide that. So I think everything's at a much faster burn than you normally see. Like we were saying earlier, you have Putin or Erdogan, and it took many years before things started to crisis point. And here, Trump doesn't hold back, doesn't hide who he is, and that means it's more obvious, it's easier to show people what's going to happen, but it's also happening so fast, there's less time to organize against it.
Certainly, and some examples of that would be, for example, Lester Holt, the interview that he did with Trump, where Trump piped up and said, sure, that's why I fired Michael Flynn, or excuse me, why I fired former FBI Director James Comey. I didn't like this Russia thing. That was an extraordinary admission that no lawyer, if he had control of his client, would allow.
Well, his attorney apparently tweeted out knowledge of a possible obstruction of justice.
And that today, or that this week, was John Dowd, his attorney, who said, oh yeah, Trump fired the FBI director and perhaps even leaned on him to look the other way for Michael Flynn at a time that he knew Michael Flynn had lied to the FBI. Would that in and of itself be a crime, telling somebody to lie to the FBI?
That would, I think, pretty much qualify as obstruction of justice. Although I feel like we need an asterisk next to Dowd tweeted that. I think that's still up in the air, given that Trump has a history of blaming his errant tweets on others.
At times, it does seem to have two competing theories. One is that Trump is nutty, and the other is that he's represented by very incompetent lawyers. And I suspect that there may be a little bit of each. Just a quick prediction from each of you. This time next year, will Donald Trump be president? Susan?
I'm not going to say he's not going to be, but if you asked me at the start of his term if I thought he'd be here 2 years later, I'd say for sure. I think he will be. I'm no longer confident he will be.
And what about you, Ben?
You know, I don't do predictions anymore, but the great Julia
Fair
Yaffe.
Enough. We've all been. That Julia is probably the wisest course.
Julia has a tweet pinned to the top of her Twitter feed that says, "Good night, tomorrow will be worse." And I think that's the answer to all prediction questions.
Oh, my. On that solemn note, I think we're going to have to leave it there. I want to thank all of my guests for a great discussion on the attack on the rule of law. Ian Bassin, who heads Project Democracy, Susan Simpson, a lawyer here in Washington, D.C., and Ben Wittes, who puts out the indispensable, as I say, Lawfare blog. When we come back, our Talk It Out segment, when we continue with 1 year later from KCRW. I'm Jennifer Rubin, back with 1 year later, presented by Left, Right, and Center. This is the part of the show when we talk it out, when we talk through the big political stories of the day with two political viewpoints. Since I'm representing the right, we're bringing in Jonathan Cohn, senior national correspondent at Huffington Post and author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Jennifer. Very nice to be on the show with you.
Very nice to have you. If it weren't for, I suppose, Senator Franken and the FBI director, we all might be talking about an extraordinary tax bill. It seems that this bill that was rushed through in the middle of the night by the senators with handwritten scrawls in the margin has a bunch of errors in it. Shocker. What did they mess up and what do they have to fix?
Well, it was really fascinating when that came out, and I've seen, you know, it's not unheard of for legislation to have last minute changes, et cetera, but literally whole swaths written in handwriting. And then it turned out that I think the biggest mistake is when they were juggling their various trade-offs they could make and how they could, you know, they needed to corral, they had a very thin margin to get the votes through the Senate. They agreed to restore the corporate minimum tax, which is a tax that's always been there, which is basically like the AMT for personal income tax. And it basically says if your tax gets below a certain level because you can deduct so much, this is what you have to pay. And originally they had taken it out of the bill. They threw it back in because they were going by an estimate that said it would help them generate some savings to offset another provision they wanted to take out. But they didn't have time to think through the interaction that basically if you restore that minimum tax and you're simultaneously reducing the corporate tax rate, you basically lock everybody in at that minimum tax rate. And there are a lot of companies that really depend on deductions for things like research who are suddenly going to really kind of get hammered because of this. And it's not just a worry for those companies, you know, who they may, you know, Republicans may or may not want to help out, but it turns out to be a lot of money. It's like a $200 billion mistake on a $200 billion mistake on a $1.4 trillion tax bill. So, I mean, this is a big deal, and now they got to fix it. And, you know, we're finding, you know, there's going to be other errors like this. So this is not, you know, this is not a carefully crafted piece of legislation we're dealing with here.
Yeah, you think? You know, this does come back to the process. People don't like to talk process, but if you don't have good process, the product's not going to be very good. There were really no hearings to speak of in this bill. The Democrats were locked out. I think back to 1986 when Ronald Reagan was doing his tax bill. These things usually take a year or more because it's complicated stuff. Now, one of the issues that the Senate was fighting about was the rate for the corporate tax. Wanted to take it from 35% to 20%. And there were a bunch of senators, conservatives, pro-business senators who says it's got to be 20%, not a tick above. We had a couple of senators, Senator Lee, Senator Rubio, who said, you know, why don't we just push it up to maybe 21% and change, and we can use some of that money to expand the child tax credit. That Republican leadership said, no, this is a line in the sand, and so they passed 20%. And wouldn't you know it, within 24 hours maybe, the president of the United States says, yeah, 22% sounds pretty good. Is this the health care bill all over again, that Trump can't stick to a position, so he's constantly undercutting his own side?
Let's all stipulate what I think all of us who follow politics and policy know, which is that he doesn't understand policy. I mean, even tax policy, which presumably is one, you know, as a business leader, presumably he actually knows something about tax policy. He doesn't understand the details of bills. He doesn't pay attention to them. I mean, it's just not the way he does business. And he doesn't have, you know, strong detailed commitments. He doesn't have strong detailed commitments in part because he hasn't spent the time. You'd have a strong opinion about where the corporate tax rate should be if you were actually trying to achieve a coherent policy goal. You'd say, well, I really think it's important to get it this low because I'm trying to drive investment or whatever you're trying to do. So, yeah, I think we're seeing this all over again. We've seen it over and over again in context after context. He is not a negotiating partner. I mean, I've never had this experience before where, you know, usually when you're following a policy debate, you know, you hear officials, you know, they state a position and you take that as the administration's position. And sometimes you realize, well, you may have an underling, a cabinet secretary, an advisor who may be speaking out of turn, may not know. So what you really want to know is, well, what does the president think? Because if the president says it, that is the administration's position. This is the first time I can remember when we are in the position, as a reporter, if I hear the president say something, my first question is, okay, is he actually speaking for the administration? Is that actually their policy? Or does he not know what he's talking about? And if I'm saying that as a reporter, I can only imagine what, you know, staff on Capitol Hill are saying, what members of Congress are saying. And this contributes to a sense of chaos. It contributes to that messy policymaking environment, and it produces bills with giant mistakes in them.
All right. I'm talking with Jonathan Cahn, the senior national correspondent for the Huffington Post, talking about the tax bill this week. It does remind me that when the House was considering the bill, the president, of course, was going to Asia, and Speaker of the House Ryan wisecracked that, well, maybe we'll get somewhere because the president will be in Asia. I think that was a very telling joke. We're going to shift gears just a bit. But there's a common theme here, and that is Trump likes to win. He likes to make campaign promises and keep them. In this case, it was a campaign promise concerning a very touchy foreign policy issue, recognition of Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. He made a historic announcement yesterday to move the embassy. Democrats were on both sides of this issue. Why are they dividing? And is there some rhyme or reason to whether they're quietly approving or they're raising the alarm?
Well, look, I mean, I think, you know, we've seen in the past, and I should say that in terms of my expertise, I know domestic policy much better than foreign policy, but my sense is that Democrats are, there's division within, there's genuine division within the caucus on this. They are subject to the same push and pull of different forces. They have donors, they have constituencies. I wonder too, I can't help but wonder, watching this, the speech, Trump speak yesterday, I don't know about you, but I was sort of struck by the fact that I had this 1-2 reaction. When the first reaction was, it was a more subdued Trump speech than usual, right? The language was a little more nuanced than it wasn't as bombastic as it could have been. You could have imagined a version of Trump's speech yesterday that was much more out there, right? And it wasn't. And thinking that, okay, this sounds more like a politician normally would sound, although he's taking a very radical position relative to American history, recent American history. And yet then this sort of second realization is, wait a minute, that's where we are now, where we're sort of, at the point where when the president doesn't say something totally, crazy and doesn't go off
insane,
sort of foaming at the mouth, we're like, oh good, that's an improvement. So I wonder, to what extent there's a little bit, even among Democrats, a little sense of, okay, well, we thought this was going to a place we were more fearful of, and this isn't quite there, so maybe we feel a little bit, a little more comfortable here. But, it's hard to say. I do think there's genuine division within the Democratic ranks over this, and I think some of that is what you're seeing.
Fair enough. Yes, I think George W. Bush called this the soft bigotry of low expectations, which certainly applies to Donald Trump. Let's talk now about entitlement cuts. I bet you saw this coming, Jonathan. We've just gone through a spate of debates on taxes, tax cutting. They have a bill out there that's going to lose at least $1.5 trillion in revenue. And now the Republicans have decided that they're fiscal conservatives, and they're now talking about cutting Medicaid, Medicare. Is that really going to happen?
We did see this coming. In fact, we were looking back. I mean, we actually, I remember writing about this with a colleague of mine back in December after the election, that this was probably coming down the pike, because this has always been something that Paul Ryan has cared a lot about. He wants to cut Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, and he's, to his credit, has always been fairly open about that. It does take, some moxie to pass a tax bill that will drive up the deficit, and just sort of be fine with that, not have a worry about that, and then turn around and say, "Oh my God, we have a debt problem. We need to cut spending on entitlements in order to get the debt down." Will they go there? I don't know. I mean, the normal laws of political gravity would say no way in a million years would they go there. They just, got hammered over the last year politically for trying to cut the Affordable Care Act, very much so because they were trying to cut Medicaid. So why would they now go after Medicare, right, which, if anything, is more popular than Medicaid? But, if the last year has taught us anything, I mean, they will keep trying this. And, I will be interested to see whether they try it. I would expect if they do, they will run into similar opposition. Medicare, last I checked, is a pretty popular program. But, who knows?
Well, Paul Ryan has tried this many times before. He's never succeeded. And now it may be a little bit different with a Republican president in the White House. But I kind of think that this is sort of like the homeowner who runs off to Vegas, blows his salary, and then comes back and says, "I can't really pay my mortgage, and you kids, you're not getting dinner or breakfast." So thanks to my guest, Jonathan Cohn, senior national correspondent at the Huffington Post, author of Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. That's it for today on One Year Later. Meet us back here tomorrow for the show on Democrats. Can they get their act together to capitalize on the GOP in chaos? We're going to leave you with I Fought the Law and the Law Won by the Bobby Fuller Four. One Year Later is a co-production of KCRW, Los Angeles, and Public Radio International. I left my baby and a
the law and the law won.
PRI, Public Radio National.